Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to a very special Empire podcast. There is no regular podcast this week as we're off for Christmas. Oh, yes, indeed. But we couldn't leave an empty slot in your podcast library now, could we? No, we couldn't. So here, as a special pre-Christmas bonus, our Christmas present to you, if you will, is an interview with the great Hugh Jackman. His new movie, The Greatest Showman, is out on Boxing Day and is a Barnum-storming musical about how P.T. Barnum, for it is he, founded the most legendary circus this side of Monty Python's Flying. It stars Jackman, of course, as Barnum, along with Zac Efron, Zendaya, Michelle Williams and Rebecca Ferguson, and is something of a passion project for the Aussie star who has shepherded this original musical with original songs to the big screen over the course of several years. So what you're about to hear is not a career-focused piece, it's an interview that focuses mainly, very tightly, on The Greatest Showman, in particular the difficulty of writing original songs for a musical. But there is some stuff in there about Jackman's wider career, in particular Logan, for he has had a cracking year. We've had Hugh on the podcast a few times now, he's always fun. He's always engaged, he's always interesting, and I had an absolute blast with this, and hey, you know what? I hope you guys do too. Right, that's enough Jackman-splaining from me. Here is the interview. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast once again by the legend that is Hugh Jackman.
How are you, sir? Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. How are you feeling? You all right?
I'm excellent.
Let's talk about movies and the cracking year you've had.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a one hell of a year for you. You're going to bookend it with Logan and The Greatest Showman.
Yeah.
Two passion projects for you.
I must admit, this has been a year for me. on many levels, because I think 7 years ago when this was starting, and particularly 3 years ago, so when we were starting with Logan, is one of those times in a career where you wake up and go, all right, I'm in this position. These movies are kind of getting made because of me. Like, I understand that I'm in a position of power and I have definite instincts about how it should go. And there's a certain team I want to put together. And with both the directors and the team and the studio we worked with, it felt like I was really involved, and I'm really relieved and proud, not just the juxtaposition of doing like a hard-edged, dramatic film like Logan with action in it, but then going to a musical. That's one thing I love, but more just the investment I had in both projects and how they came out.
Yeah, and both musicals as well.
Exactly. And who knew Barnum could be a musical? You know, I mean, everyone can see Wolverine dancing and singing.
Who knew Barnum had such rage issues? That was the thing that I took away from it. But The Greatest Showman is not just a musical, it's an original musical, and that is a very rare beast these days. I mean, obviously La La Land came out at the beginning of the year, or last year in the States. Did pretty well, as far as I recall. But it is such a rare thing. Happens all the time in Broadway, obviously, but in movies is just a rare beast. How difficult is it to commit to something like that?
I've got to give props to the guys at Fox. Stacey Snyder at the time, Jim Giannopoulos and Emma Watts. These guys actually were like, yeah, let's go for it. There were times when I was a little on the fence about it. You know, I realized that doing a movie musical that is original, that fails with your name above the title, could mean it's the last chance. You know what I mean? So, and I quite like having that risk. But the studio were really into it. They were really also really into the idea of Logan. We had some fights along the way, but in general, the idea of doing something completely different and changing up what had been for them a successful formula, you know, was a risk they didn't necessarily have to take.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And so in that way, it's been really interesting. I'm really proud of being involved with two things that I just sort of trust with my gut, and not only me, a lot of the other people. I've lost the question. I'm just talking now.
But the question was about original songs, really, and about
So it had been 23 years since Hollywood had done an original movie musical. It was a thing called Newsies, which, ironically, my wife was in, by the way.
Really?
My wife plays Christian Bale's mum in
the
movie.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
That is the last, or that or Fame, people say, those were the last original movie musicals.
Yeah.
Everything else has either originated on Broadway or like Moulin Rouge, some sort of jukebox musical.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It was, I thought, a 1 in 10 chance when we first took it. When the studio said, yeah, sure, let's commission a script. And the script came in and I was like, oh, that's good, that's interesting. And this subject is interesting, but we've got to get the music, original music. And, you know, that... It's really difficult to ask an audience to hear 10 songs they've never heard before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To be humming those tunes the next day to love the tunes without having heard them before and go along with a story. That's probably why it's considered a bridge too far.
Yeah.
La La Land was being developed at the same time. Actually, Justin and Benj, who wrote all our music, won the Oscar for the lyrics for La La Land, but they were hired, I think, 2 years after they started working with us. We heard them first.
We saw them. We got dibs.
Anyway, it's interesting. I think in general, I know people say, oh, movies, it's all sequels and all that, but I think a lot of risks are being taken. I think it's kind of a necessity. I think so many risks and so many great characters, storylines, writing are happening in TV series now. Mm. There's just such great quality that movies are having to differentiate themselves. They have to find a way to compel people to go to the movies, and they've all got to be good.
So when you commission a script, an original script for a film like this, it's a musical, and it comes in, is it literally like the Star Wars script where it just goes, they fight? Does it now go, and now they sing? There is a song here.
Yes.
But we just don't know what that song
is. And actually, for a lot of it, there wasn't even an end song.
Right.
It could be maybe song here.
Okay.
Because Jenny Bix, who wrote the first draft, she's a writer on it, you know, she doesn't write musicals. So that is a real art in itself, how to incorporate song. Because songs, if you resolve everything in the scene and then the song is just like reiterating what happened in the scene, it's pretty boring. So the songs have to be a continuation of the scene.
Yeah.
They have to advance plot. They have to advance character.
Yeah.
And in general, the rule is if you can no longer speak in the scene, you sing. And if you can no longer walk, you dance. So it has to be emotional. You have to have a reason, basically. That's the basic theory. So, the first draft was a really good, solid sort of version of P.T. Barnum in this story.
Uh-huh.
But no one had any idea where the music was going to be. No one.
That's amazing. And because there's a very generous spread of songs in the film as well. Everybody gets a moment. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets to sing. Mm. Was that important to you as well, that it wasn't just Barnum barnstorming the film?
100%. Although, I mean, Barnum, in real life, his name was everywhere. It was Barnum's Circus. It was Barnum's this. His autobiography, he boasted, was the number two bestseller next to the Bible. He interestingly wrote three versions of his autobiography.
Right, okay.
When he got to the second or third, he burnt all of the copies of the number one that were still around. He bought them up and burnt them because he completely reinvented the story.
I might take notes.
He's a great character, but he also understood. He knows what people want. He used to constantly say, it's a line in the movie, if you haven't been to the Barnum Museum lately, you haven't been to the Barnum Museum. So he knew that thing that people need to see things they don't expect. Their expectations need to be not just met but exceeded. You have to constantly surprise and amaze and create things and move them forward.
Mm.
I don't think Barnum would, if he was alive today, he wouldn't be in a big top 10 doing a circus. I'm positive of that. I think he'd be probably around Silicon Valley somewhere doing virtual reality or doing some form of storytelling that we hadn't seen before, that he could get to as many people as possible and make as much money out of it as possible.
Fair enough. And when you're putting together songs for a film like this, how many songs do you have? How many fall by the wayside during the
so many.
The process.
First of all, the process originally, and I agreed with this process, was we would go out to the best and most famous songwriters in the world. So Pharrell Williams, who's a writer, producer as well, Bruno Mars guy, Phil, we had a lot of big names. We went to all of them, and Michael would go and pitch it, and then they were Lady Gaga, Gwen Stefani, you name it. We went to all of these guys. So the studio felt we need to have a movie that's going to play for everybody. Mm-hmm. The songs have to feel like they could be in a musical, but believe they live on radio.
There's a real pop edge to the songs here,
And so that was the brief. We thought probably 10 songs. I didn't want to do what we did in Les Mis, which was wall-to-wall singing.
Yep.
I like the idea of the traditional musical where you have scenes going into a song. Actually, I think at first I was thinking 6 to 7. I kind of thought a modern audience, more than 6 or 7 songs is probably too many. How many did La La Land have?
La La Land only really had about 6 or 7. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So and one of those was City of Stars 25 times. So
I thought that's kind of where audiences won't allow you to break into song and dance easily anymore. They won't just accept that. So doing it 10 times might be really difficult.
True. But one of my great joys is whenever I do see a musical on Broadway or in the West End,
yeah,
and it clicks with me in a big way, like Book of Mormon or Groundhog Day,
yes,
getting the soundtrack album,
yeah,
afterwards and just playing it over and over again. Same. And that's 15, 16 songs. So yeah, you have to, I guess, fall in that middle ground in a way.
Yeah, so I don't know how many we thought we'd end up with in the end. It was 10, and I think that's basically because of Justin and Benj,
yeah,
who wrote the music, and every single song is great. Mm. And I haven't told Justin and Benj, I don't mind me telling him this, but telling you this. After they'd written about 4 or 5 songs, at this point they were now on board, and everyone else had fallen by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
A few lies along the way to the studio about how important these guys were. Michael Gracie told one studio exec that they'd won a Tony Award recently, because they said, who are these guys? Oh, they just won a Tony Award. For what? James and the Giant Peach. And the guy goes, oh, okay. Now, there's never been a Broadway production of James and the Giant Peach. Well, that seems like a good idea.
It does, doesn't it?
So a few lies to get them in. Okay. Now, of course, they don't talk to us. But about 4 or 5 songs in, I sent it to Baz Luhrmann, because I think Baz has brilliant. And by the way, Michael Gracie, the director, worked on Moulin Rouge. You can probably feel it a little bit.
Yeah,
in the movie. It's got that quality.
How does that feel?
And he wrote back to me. He rang me. He goes, Hugh, you've got something very rare here. And I said, what's that? And he goes, you've got, I think, 3 hooks. I said, I didn't know what he was talking about. He goes, a hook is the most difficult thing to write in pop music. Andrew Lloyd Webber had it for a while. Like, he could just write a song and it would stick in your head and you would love it.
Yeah.
And I sent him, I think, 4 or 5, and he goes, you got 3. And he goes, if you have 3 total in your movie, that's unbelievable. He goes, you can have a hit with 2 hooks in a musical and you can get by with 1. He goes, you've already got 3. He says, now the songs still need developing, they need producing, but don't throw that away. Like, and we always had that strength. I think probably the real strength of this musical right now is the music.
Mm. I mean, have you ever been tempted to write stuff yourself?
A little bit tempted.
Mm.
But
you've never done the thing where you pick up the guitar and...
I'm just getting back to the piano and learning that now. And occasionally I have some friends who write songs and they're like, come on in. But I have not, prior to this, enjoyed being in the recording studio.
Really?
Yeah, I get asked to record a lot. And actually someone recently, I was amazed I got asked to record something with this person. And I just said, I just wrote back, I said, I love you. I just don't love me in there. Like, I don't enjoy it. It's not a lot of fun. I get very self-critical.
Uh-huh.
A friend of mine said, you're just not clearly drinking enough when you record. Like, no one does it sober, man. Like,
yeah, you need some lubrication. That's
yeah,
that's
but
the
with
thing.
This,
yeah.
Honestly, we went in so many times, so many sessions. I had a new singing teacher for 2 years to get that more pop sound. And Justin, in particular, Paul was in there line by line. I remember one point after a 3-hour session on a song, Michael Gracie came in and said, he goes, he's heard a comp after the 3 hours, and he goes, wow, Hugh, this is great. Like, very surprised.
Thanks a bunch.
I said, yeah, a little too surprised. And I said, yeah, thanks. And the engineer, I overheard him say, there's a lot of takes. So I sort of bludgeoned through my... Anyway, that's my long answer to around why I may not have written. I may get there eventually.
There's not like a drawer full of Hugh Jackman penned classics in waiting.
There just mustn't be enough pain yet. not enough synthesized pain for me to be able to put it into a song. It's just generalized stuff. But maybe I'll get there.
When was the first time you realized you could sing? Like, properly sing? Not just, you know, sing something in the shower, a couple of songs. But you were really good at it.
I've always felt that I was a better actor than a singer. So I thought I was better off in a song that had something to say, had an emotional state that I could feel, that I was leading acting chin first.
Right, yeah.
I had some moments. I remember singing something from Chess. I could feel it really working. That was a drama school. When I was doing Oklahoma Here, there were some moments that I was like, oh, this, I just feel right at home. But there's just as many times where I started to feel more on stage. Like, while I was on stage doing musicals like Beauty and the Beast or Sunset Boulevard or Oklahoma, where I'd get asked to go and sing, like at the Bledisloe Cup, at the national anthem in front of 90,000 people, and I literally had a panic attack the night before.
Oh my God, really?
And I felt like a complete fraud. So, if someone at a dinner party said, "Oh, Hugh, get up and sing," I'd be like, and my wife, every time she has three drinks, she's like, "Oh my, my husband sings, sing a song, come on." She's like one of those frustrated singers. She will sing a song, and she will say, she doesn't understand why everyone doesn't sing a song. And I was like, "Oh, kick him!" And I said, "No." And I used to get, I'm like, I'm not that kind of singer. I'm not a real singer. I'm just pretending. Like I'm. So for a long time, I felt like a fraud. And I think the most comfortable I've been probably was when I did my own one man show.
Okay.
And then into this. I think.
The Boy from Mars or the, no, or the one the, you did recently, the Broadway one?
Yeah,
the
Broadway show, my show. Because it was incredibly self-indulgent.
Yeah.
I was picking songs that I loved that totally suited my voice that I enjoyed singing. My rule was if the orchestra started up and I didn't feel like, "Oh, I love this song," then I would cut it. Oh, wow. For the next one.
That's the way to go. That is the way to go. We talked earlier on about great entrances in movies, and you know, there's huge importance to Barnum's entrance in this, and to Logan's entrance in Logan. I love the fact that his entrance in Logan, where he comes up from the limousine, and the very first thing we hear from your mouth is the F word.
Yes.
Suddenly we know we're in completely different territory.
Yeah.
How important is it for you to have a great entrance and to nail that?
Yeah, I'm big on entrances. I'm very aware when I go onto a set, even if it's day 35 and I know it's the introduction of a character, it's huge. And I learned that actually on X-Men 1. I think it took me a little while to get into the character of Logan, and thankfully Brian held back that opening scene in the cage. That bar fighting scene was one of the last things we did.
Right.
And physically I was in better shape than when I began. And also I just had...
The beer got it gone.
Yeah, the beer got it gone. Damn it. I think it's really important. The impression you set an audience in every way carries through the rest of the film. I mean, Cape Fear, when you see De Niro in that cell doing push-ups or pull-ups or something, you're frightened of him for the rest of the movie, even when he's being completely charming, you know. Mm. So it's important. But beyond my own character, this, I'm in the opening frame of the movie and it's the beginning of the show. We deliberately wanted to make people go, "What?" Like, they're settled in, eating their popcorn. I wanted their mouth to be open, half-chewed popcorn kind of dribbling out of their mouth. And Michael was like, "I want people to go, what the hell is going on? I didn't expect this. This is not the world I expected."
Okay.
And take them a bit by surprise. So the music, the boom, boom, that whole thing was just designed to really
shot from
whack people between the eyes and go, "This is the ride you're in for. Get ready.
This is not your grandmother's musical."
No.
That kind of thing.
But I can hear the studio. Grandmothers will love it, though.
All are welcome to The Greatest Showman. All are welcome.
All are welcome.
And just a very last thing before we finish. I don't know if you saw this, but Marvel have announced a scripted Wolverine podcast. This was announced yesterday as a 10-part thing. They're going to try and emulate the success of Serial. So it's a murder mystery set up in the Alaskan wastes with Wolverine as one of the Logan as one of the suspects in this thing, and he's going to be voiced by Richard Armitage. Now, do you feel even slightly in your metal bones, just a little bit of jealousy about that someone else is going to be playing Wolverine, even on a podcast?
No, no, I don't.
You're done.
No.
That's it, you're out.
I always thought, like, hey, by the way, not only Du Grey Scott, but I know Russell Crowe was offered the part. I know I was coming deep.
I was offered the part at one point.
I was not only coming off the bench, deep on the bench. I let that ego go. I don't care. Like, and in a way, I'm excited to see what other people do with it. You know, people say, "What do you think of Tom Hardy?" I go, "I would love to see Tom Hardy. Like, he would be amazing." But I also feel confident enough to say, you can't take away what I did either, whether you like it or not. That's done, and that's sort of there. I don't, and I do know about this particular thing. Mm-hmm. I knew about it in development.
Okay,
and
okay.
I'm being careful as I speak because I'm not sure how much I should have known.
All right, okay.
There was a sneaky email or two from people I know in that process, like, "Hey,
are you
interested? Could this be a cool little addendum?" And a little part of me thought, that's cool. And then another part of me was like, no, let someone else do it. So that's why I answer so definitively.
And the very last thing, I asked Jim Mangold this morning, we had him on for the Logan spoiler special. At any point, was there pressure from within the studio to have that beautiful last shot? And you hold in the last shot, the cross has become an X on Logan's grave, and you hold for ages, and then all of a sudden you just hear, "Let me out."
What did he say?
He said no. He was a little bit more profane, perhaps, than that. But I'm just saying, you know, would you be interested in recording "Let Me Out" so we can just dub
it
over?
That could be really fun. I think maybe for the DVD extras.
I was only kidding. I didn't take all that liquid, green liquid. I'm kidding.
I'm better.
It just reminds me of the Monty Python.
Oh,
bring
my
out
God.
You're dead. I'm not dead yet.
I got better.
Shut up. No, he's not.
Boom, he is now. Amazing. Hugh Jackman on that note.
Great to see you, man. It's always good for a laugh. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Cheers, man.
And that's it from this Hugh Jackman interview special. We're filling the void again next week with our View of the Year special. That's going to be up January 29th, Friday, January 29th. The regular podcast is back on Jan 5th. With Joe Wright and Andrea Riseborough. Our Star Wars The Last Jedi spoiler special with director Rian Johnson is up on January 15th. And Denis Villeneuve joins us for a Blade Runner 2049 spoiler special at long last. That'll be up around the end of Jan to coincide with that film's DVD and Blu-ray release. So you're going to have something to listen to even while we are sunning ourselves in front of a Christmas tree, which is nice. Until next time, I'm Chris Hewitt. I'm off to listen to The Greatest Showman soundtrack. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.